Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Good day. Welcome to New Books in History, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. My name is Dr. Charles Cutillo of the Royal Historical Society. I'm a host on the channel, and today I'm pleased and honored to have with us Professor Alexander Mikhabitsa of Louisiana State University. Professor Mikhabitsa has written a number of well-received books dealing with the era of the French Revolutionary Napoleonic Wars. And today, we are going to be discussing his newest book, The Napoleonic Wars, A Global History, published by Oxford University Press. Welcome, Professor.
Thank you so much for having me, Dr. Cutillo. It's a real pleasure to be there.
Thank you. If your book could be said to have a thesis, what would it be?
The book is, it does indeed have a thesis, and it is one that is trying to challenge the traditional narrative of the Revolutionary Napoleonic Wars. Much is written about this subject in the past 200 years, but virtually everything is Eurocentric in the sense that it is written with either Napoleon in mind, so Napoleon is at the core of the story, or as focused on events in Western and Central Europe. So my book tries to move away from this traditional approach and showcase the global ramifications of the Napoleonic Wars by touching upon other areas. Even within Europe, for example, traditional narrative tends to ignore events in Scandinavia, events in the Balkan Peninsula, so I bring that to the fold. But then I also move away to other parts of the world, such as Latin America, Middle East, parts of Asia, India, China, Japan, and try to draw the connections between what was happening in Europe and how that translated to these faraway corners of the world and what was the impact of Napoleonic Wars. And I think in that sense, this book is fresh and new in its approach.
And would it be correct to say that if your book could be said to have a hero, I use the word hero in quotation marks, it would be Bonaparte?
I noticed the Bonaparte use on your part. No, I don't think, yes and no, in the sense that, you know, since you said it's a hero in quotation marks, then I think I'll be using that word as well. I don't perceive Napoleon necessarily as a hero. I perceive him as a historically very important individual, very interesting individual. There are many aspects of his character, of his life that are quite appealing, quite interesting. I've been reading his correspondence for many, many years, and we've actually been reading yesterday some of the newly published volumes of his correspondence, and reading those letters, you cannot walk away not appreciating the skill, the gift that this man had to control this enormous machinery. It certainly takes a skill. So I do look at him as a very gifted, very talented man, but I also am fully aware of those less appealing character traits that he has. He is an ambitious man. He is oftentimes an opportunist. is a deceiver, and he certainly is a cynic. So I certainly am not the fan of, you know, like in a Bonapartist kind of fan, but I'm willing to give him some benefit of a doubt in light of the events that they transpired. So I think some of the reviewers of my book noted that I'm as critical of the British as I am of the French, and I'm as critical of the French as I am of the Russians. So I think I try to be balanced, not to be critical of any one side too much. For example, I take an issue. Why we call this conflict the Napoleonic Wars? Why? Because Napoleon doesn't bear the overwhelming burden of it. There are many other countries who share the responsibility for this conflict and for the long nature of it. So that's, I think, what my hope was in this book, to offer a balanced approach.
What do you attribute the origins of the Revolutionary Wars, which commenced in the spring of 1792?
That's a complex question. And the short answer, I think, will be the argument that I'm making in my book is that I don't look at the Revolutionary Wars as necessarily a new era in military affairs. There is an element to that. Certainly, later on, the rise of a mass conscription armies, as the France practices in the wake of Levée en Masse, 1793, certainly affects the military. But I situate French Revolutionary and Napoleonic Wars firmly in the context of the 18th century geopolitical struggles. So the war might have started in April of 1792 in response to the events, revolutionary events in France. But it quickly lost its ideological element, so to speak, and reverted back to the control and the issues of control and power. So we see, for example, by 1796-97, Napoleon, when he's appealing to his soldiers, he's not talking about necessarily the revolutionary ideals, but he talks about the good old, payments on time, payments in cash. We talk about the directory, the French Revolutionary Government seeking to control the areas from Netherlands to Belgium to Rhineland to Italy, not necessarily to free, quotation marks, of the local regions, but to control and exploit them. And that's where I see is the conundrum, or it's the complex character of the Revolutionary Wars. The early appeals, the early discussions of freedom, spreading this freedom and liberty to other areas, were quickly subverted by much more material considerations than desire for control of those areas.
To backtrack a little bit, can you tell the audience, in outline form at least, a little bit about the international 18th century international order?
Yes. So what is interesting in about 18th century is that it develops several principles, several pillars of what will be the 19th and in many respects 20th century international politics. And one of the core elements of this story is the emergence of the great powers, and the very term, the great power and then great power, puissance and grand puissance, as they were used at the time, are actually terms that were forged at this time. So in essence, in Europe, in the 18th century, we have a series of nations, countries that are more powerful than the others. So we've talked about France, Britain, Russia, especially in the wake of the Seven Years' War, Austria, and Russia. So these great powers are dominant in Europe, and we can consider them as the great powers, even though this term will not be fully enshrined until after the Napoleonic Wars. At the Congress of Vienna, for example, it is used quite frequently. And so these five great powers are locked in the tide of conflict and competition with each other, which has been taking place quite frequently in the 18th century. Think of the War of Spanish Succession, with which the century began between 1700 and 1714, followed by the Wars of Polish Succession, Austrian Succession, Seven Years' War, and finally the French Revolutionary War. But each of these powers, I argue, in my country have a specific outlook on the world. And I group them in several categories. So in the first category, I argue that there are powers that have solely continental outlook. And I count Austria and Prussia as the prime examples of this, meaning that these are the two countries who don't have possessions outside Europe, and they are in many respects landlocked countries, right? They do have maybe access to sea, but they don't have the navy, so to speak. So Austria and Prussia are good examples in that sense. And so they are focusing primarily to maintaining their positions on the continent. That is different from the second category of those European powers whose interests are not solely confined to Europe. So, for example, France and Britain, but also Russia, Portugal, Spain, they all had possessions overseas. And so they had both European interests, but also colonial interests. Think about France and having possessions in Caribbean. Think about Britain and the control of Canada, great interest in India. But of course, most famously, think about Spain, right? Relatively small country as far as Europe is concerned, but in control of enormous colonial empire overseas. And then the third group of countries that I identify are the other powers that are trying to survive in these international affairs dominated by the great powers. So think about the Dutch Republic, for example. Think about Italian states who have to position themselves in such a way as to survive in the tide of war, or conflict and competition between the great powers. And these relations, of course, are quite interesting because another principle that emerges in the 18th century is understanding that there is a need for certain balance. And so if there is a theme that you see throughout my book is the theme of developing a balance of power, a notion that there needs to be a certain political equilibrium between the great powers. And once you achieve that equilibrium, there will be a peace and stability in Europe. There will be no war, and Europe will be slowly able to develop. It's the achieving that political equilibrium that is so difficult, making sure that each power is not too powerful. So it will take the revolutionary Napoleonic Wars to finally achieve certain parity between the great powers, and that parity then will survive for about four decades, bringing considerable prosperity to Europe.
Would you agree with the American diplomatic historian Paul Schroeder in his categorization by the late 18th century, but prior to 1792, that of the powers that you just mentioned, that there was a first tier and a second tier, first tier in essence being Russia and Great Britain, second tier being France, and the third tier being Austria and Prussia?
Yes, absolutely. In a sense that France used to be the first tier, and one of the core reasons for the the problems that I discuss in my book is the reality that France is indeed falling in the second tier. And I mentioned problems that France is experiencing at this time, not the least is the financial crisis that in turn affects its military capability. So to give you a sense, in 1787, there was a attempted revolution in the neighboring Netherlands, and where you have the more Francophile faction attempting to secure power, and the revolution is suppressed by Prussian invasion. So certainly in 1787, it is clear that France is a second-tier power since it can't even defend its own backyard, so to speak, against the Prussian invasion. But in my book, what I argue is that Schroeder is correct about outlining these tiers, but I think there is another tier of the fourth, tier that deals with the remaining powers that have to survive in between those tiers, between Russia and Prussia and Austria. I have here in mind the Polish state, which ultimately doesn't make it, is squeezed by this first and second tier states out of existence by 1795.
Why did the war of the first coalition turn out the way it did?
I think that's where My argument of connecting these wars to the previous, more geopolitical realities of the 18th century, maybe playing it out, if we look at how the war began, it began in April 1792 with France unprepared for the war, neither politically nor militarily, and France was suffering significant setbacks that only increased after the execution of the king in January of 1793. So here we see a massive coalition of European states trying to contain this French threat. But by 1795, the situation has changed, right? The French revolutionary governments, through a rather ruthless but efficient policies, including the Great Terror, including the levy en masse, including the law of maximum, and all this, were able to mobilize the resources of the entire nation and contain these coalition attacks. Not just contain, actually, they went on counteroffensive, so that by 1795, France is actually is engaging the coalition on their terms. But what happens at the same time is also interesting, is that at that same time, the future of Poland is being decided. So here you see this opportunism of the great powers. So while Europe's attention is focused on France, Poland endures two partitions, right, in 1792-93, and then a third partition in 1795, with Austria, Prussia, and Russia, the great powers who one probably should have expected being engaged in a conflict with France, actually focusing their energies more on the partitioning of Poland, which is snuffed out of existence in 1795. So here we see the geopolitical arrangements, right? But it also, the same kind of spillover effect we can see in Italy, where the war for a while was contained. France was unable to cross the Alps, right, in 93, 94, 95. But it is Napoleon, the newly appointed commander-in-chief of the Army of Italy, who is able, through his skill, through his ingenuity, to inflict crushing defeats on Austria and the Italian states and secure the control of Italy in 1796. By this time, then, other coalition partners decide to leave the coalition, realizing that this is becoming a too much of a conflict. So, for example, Spain signs the treaty and leaves the coalition, and not just leaves, it actually switches the sides and becomes a French partner. Prussia, again, it's 1795, but the Treaty of Basel also gets out of coalition to pursue its own interests. And that's, I think, a core problem of the coalition warfare, is that members of the coalition might have a common enemy, but they also have inherently different ideas of how to fight that enemy, but also what their own goals are. And for a while, in fact, if we look at the French Revolutionary and Napoleonic Wars, one of the reasons why the French were so successful until 1812 was exactly the problem of coalition warfare. How do you convince the members of coalition to fight the same war? And until 1812, specifically 1830, the Russian defeat that Napoleon suffers, the coalition members can't agree on this. And even in 13, we see the problems of coalition warfare, but they are not as pronounced. At least the coalition members can agree on the need to defeat Napoleon and then pursue it, even though there are inherently conflicting interests that they have.
To go into a counterfactual, would it have been the case that a more aggressive commander than the Duke of Brunswick would have swept the French from the battlefield circa September 1792 at Valmy, or even with a more aggressive commander, the result would have been the same given the lateness of the season for campaigning?
I think we need two things here. One is political will, and second is, vigorous and more engaged commander. The reality is that we lack both, in the sense that Prussian interest in 1792 lay more in the second partition of Poland than they are in containing the French threat. Frankly, neither Prussia nor Austria anticipated the problem, or could have anticipated, or and certainly didn't anticipate, or didn't foresee how big of a problem French Revolutionary government would become later on. They believed that this would be a contained affair. Certainly Britain also, right? And as far as many British circles are concerned, they looked at the French Revolution as a repeat of the British revolutionary events from a century ago. So they were not particularly keen on getting engaged in this conflict. But this, if we assume these two counterfactuals, then yes, it will be an interesting thing to ponder. The French army was in disarray in 1792. The Battle of Valmy is not necessarily a battle as such, right? If we look at the battle, it has an interesting elements to it. It's artillery, right? Cannonade. It's not the traditional vision of a battle with lines charging and hand-to-hand fighting. And a general of different stature, or maybe mindset than Brunswick. Somebody maybe like, oh, if we're looking of old mold, of Duke of Savoy or Eugene of Savoy, maybe, if not of a new mold, like Bonaparte would have made short work of the French army.
Or even someone
but we
like,
need a political will.
Or even someone like the Austrian general Lacy, who had triumphed in the Turkish War that just concluded.
That's right. But that's a part of the equation, right? Second part will be the political will. Was there a will, or could there have been a will to prosecute this war to the end? That's a good counterfactual question to ponder, because both Austria and Prussia, as we have seen, have at least one eye, if not more, on this. Pieces of Poland that are being partitioned in the East.
Why, as you term it, was the 5 years between 1797 and 1802, quote, crucial in shaping the course of European history, unquote?
So my argument is this. By this time, right, the France has established itself as the dominant Western power, or at least the dominant power in Western Europe, to be precise. And over those 5 years, what Bonaparte is doing is trying to consolidate his positions. And he's successful in this. And that's why I argue is that this French ability to use this period to establish themselves firmly in Western Europe is the foundation for events to come. And here it's not just military success, it's also the success of exporting French ideas. Not necessarily revolutionary ideas, but the ideas of a different kind of governance, different kind of approach to control of populations, different kind of approach to the extracting resources from populations. French are pioneers in how they do this at this period. And by controlling territories, the newly conquered territories, they're exporting this approach to those territories and increasingly establishing themselves in firm control. It is the control of these areas that will then allow France to continue the war, to sustain the war for the years to come.
What were the interplay between war and political development in France in the years 1792 up to 1799?
François Furet, the great French historian, when he wrote the history, thinking about French history, he once observed that war conducted revolution far more than the revolution conducted the war. And I think that is at the core of this question that you asked. And what he meant by this was that once the war began in 1792, the way war developed, the way international relations developed during this war, profoundly affected the political development in France. And after the summer of 1792, towards the fall, it is the war that increasingly drove the political developments within France and contributed to the rapid radicalization of the French political discourse. If we look at the great events the great journées, right, the great revolutionary upheavals. Whether we talk about the collapse of French monarchy in August, on August 10, 1792, or the infamous massacres of September 1792, or the revolts of May 31, June 2nd of 1793 that brought the radical Jacobins to power. All these events are connected to the events on the front line. Usually these are setbacks of the French experience, which then reverberate back on the political front. The very notion of the Great Terror, the terror campaign that Jacobins unleashed starting in the summer of 1793, was carried out within the context of a national security, right? Jacobins always argued that what they were doing is trying to protect the nation at this very difficult moment for the country. And they used the terror campaign as a way of rooting out the enemies, both on the within the France, before the war is lost. So war is crucial to radicalization of revolution. I don't think revolution would have developed this the way it did without the impact of the war.
What were Bonaparte's goals in foreign policy upon assuming power in 1799?
His immediate goal was to consolidate what he already had. And in my book, I have a passage where I'm arguing that it doesn't really matter whether we have a Bonaparte or any other general, because we know that France had a generation of very ambitious and talented generals at this time. Whether it was Bonaparte or not, any head of the state that France would have had at this time would have taken advantage of the reality that he was facing. And the reality was that France had won the first two coalition wars and that it was in control of this enormous territory that included parts of Netherlands, Belgium, Rhineland, parts of Switzerland, and most of northern Italy. And what Bonaparte did upon coming to power was to consolidate control in these areas. And my argument is that any head of the state who would have come to power in France at this time, whether it was directory or a dictator, so to speak, of Bonaparte's mold, would have done the same thing. And as a result of these developments, of course, France consolidated its position in Western Europe. And that in itself challenged the existing political order of things in international affairs in Europe and threatened the interests of many other European states, certainly Austrians, who are now excluded from most of Italy, northern Italy, certainly Prussian and Russian interests, since what one of the things Napoleon started to do was to consolidate French interests in the southern Germany, right, the famous imperial recess by which he started to restructure the German states, and of course the British, who are quite worried about the French control of the Low Countries, the Austrian Netherlands and the Dutch Republic themselves. And so Napoleon was that's in foreign affairs, that's his immediate goal, and he's quite successful in this. Now, that success, however, did cause him to overreach, I think. For example, he pledged not to annex territories in Italy, but by 1802 he will start annexing territories. Parts of Piedmont will become part of France. So those actions will alienate and certainly contribute to the outbreak of the war. But Bonaparte's other goal is to bring order and stability within France. And we see that happening quite effectively between 1800 and 1803, when in a series of very interesting reforms, Napoleon was able to restore a semblance of order and stability in France. It happened at a high cost. Certainly, we can consider some of the things that he had done as draconian. But for the contemporaries, they were not efforts were not perceived as such. So, for example, his establishment of a new corps of gendarmerie, armed gendarmerie, to go into countryside and suppress banditry and other criminality did cause death of quite a significant number of individuals. But from the contemporary point of view, this was a necessary evil to rein in the turmoil and chaos that the revolution produced, which is why at this time Bonaparte is largely popular. He promised to deliver order and stability, and he effectively does. So there is a certain support for him at this time.
Why did the British and the French come to terms in 1801, especially, and in particular, why did the British do so?
That goes to the heart, and I think to the of the book, and also to a bigger question of why the war began in 1803. So, by 1802, France and Britain will sign the Peace of Amiens, to be precise, on March 25 of 1802, and this peace will be the pinnacle of 2 years of negotiations that began almost as soon as Bonaparte came to power. And that's one of the goals Napoleon had when he secured power, is to restore peace as a gateway to the order and stability that will come. And so he writes this rather famous letter to King George saying, "The war, which for 8 years has ravaged the four quarters of the world, must it be eternal?" And I think that's a reflection of the reality that both sides are quite tired of the war that has been raging for almost a decade, and there is not much to show for it. And so they do agree on this Treaty of Amiens. But the problem with a Treaty of Amiens, and I think, again, it goes to why it later on collapsed, was that it has some very interesting elements, some good elements, but it also has major problems. So to start with, Amiens brought an end to the French Revolutionary Wars. So the first two coalitions were unable to defeat France, and now they are in tatters. And the British recognized the reality that they have no ally left on the continent. Every country that the British had allied with or had some kind of relationship aimed against France have been either defeated or they have left the coalition. So that includes Spain and Prussia, as I mentioned, but also Austria, which was finally defeated, right, both in 1797 and then again in 1800, while Russians are preoccupied with their own affairs. Not the least was the consolidation of power in Eastern Europe. So Britain simply faces the reality of being alone face to face with France, and there is increased unhappiness within the British public about this prospect, about the prospect of the hampered trade and economic impact that the war is having. So if we look at the treaty itself, then we see that it is broadly beneficial to France. And that's where I'm arguing that the French diplomatic team, the team that represented France at these negotiations, I think got better terms than the British team did. So if we look at the negotiation, the two key issues that negotiators focused on, these were overseas colonies and a Mediterranean region. And on both issues, Britain compromised significantly. Britain agreed, for example, to return all of its colonial conquests. So in the previous eight, almost 7 years of fighting, everything that it captured had to be returned. And it also agreed, the British agreed, to evacuate generally all the ports and islands that they seized in the Mediterranean or the Adriatic. In return, France did promise to evacuate its troops from Naples and parts of other parts of Italy. But it was not as in scale, or certainly in commitment, it was not comparable to the British commitment. If nothing else, Britain pledged to withdraw from Egypt, which Napoleon famously invaded in 1798. And there are no explicit provisions in the treaty safeguarding British trade interests on the continent, which was one of the key issues. And I think that's, a success for the French diplomacy, that they ensured that there are no provisions requiring France to to open themselves up to the British trade. The British expect that the peace that follows will result in return of the British goods, British commerce on the continent. But as we'll see, that's not what happens. Bonaparte is keen on excluding the British commerce from the continent and developing French, and that will become one of the stumbling blocks, which ultimately contributes to the collapse of the Treaty of Amiens.
What were the strategic and political consequences of the battles of Austerlitz and Trafalgar?
Some of your British listeners might not like what I have to say there. So let me start with Trafalgar, maybe. Trafalgar is a very important battle, and much has been written about it. The great victory of Horatio Nelson that eliminates 2/3 of the Franco-Spanish fleet and consolidates the British mastery of the seas. Right? The story is well known. But what I'm arguing in my book is that even though Trafalgar is one of the largest naval battles of the 19th century, its overall importance, I think, is somewhat overblown. It does have profound consequences and immediate consequences, right? So the biggest one is the fact that it removed the immediate threat of the French invasion. However, my argument is that Trafalgar's importance tends to be exaggerated. It tends to be colored by patriotic sentiment, especially the further away we get to it, many things are looked with a more pinkish eyeglasses. And Nelson himself, a friend of mine just wrote a book about Nelson in Naples, and he's gotten a lot of criticism for daring to criticize Nelson. So there is this certain don't touch the national hero, right? But what we have here is this. Trafalgar did not produce, and I want to emphasize it, did not produce the decisive consequences right away. In fact, if we look, Trafalgar is, in the larger context, immediate context, meaningless, because Napoleon went on to destroy the third and fourth coalitions in 1805, 1806, and he engineered a geopolitical shift in the Near East, where the Ottoman Empire and Iran aligned with France. So not irrespective of this naval victory that the British had, there is a massive geopolitical shift that is taking place. Second issue that I have is this. We oftentimes think that Trafalgar ended the French naval presence and that British were unchallenged on the seas. Yet, for the next 7 years, right, the British command of the seas was not as secure as we would like to see. And instead, what we see is the French continued to have naval presence. French admirals continued to conduct wide-ranging operations in the Atlantic and Indian Oceans, especially in 1807, 1808, 1809. Furthermore, Napoleon continued to replenish his naval forces by both building new fleets as well as acquiring them by conquest or by other means, which is why British had to challenge him again and again. Think about British attack on Denmark, right, in 1807. Or think about British actions in Lisbon when they effectively secured the Portuguese fleet. Or think about the expedition to Walcheren or the attack on the Basque Roads. Or later on, the French operations in the Indian Ocean that necessitate the British invasion of the Mascarene Islands. So it will take, in fact, until 1811 to fully neutralize the French naval presence. A good friend of mine, is Professor Kenneth Johnson, who has this unenviable task of writing the French naval history during this period. And he's working on his magna opus on Napoleon's use of the sea. And one of the interesting things that he uncovered is the extent to which Napoleon was able to rebuild his naval forces by 1812, by 1813. Now, he's unable to put this fleet out to use, because he's, unlike the armies where you can train them on land, the navies required extensive training out in sea, and that's one of the core problems that the French experience. So even though they are rebuilding ships, they don't have the crews to mend them to a sufficient number of them. But you know, the argument I have is that Trafalgar is important. It does neutralize short-term the French threat, but it will take many more years to actually deal with the French naval threat as a whole. On the other hand, Austerlitz, the great victory that Napoleon scored on December 2nd, 1805, also has a much more immediate geopolitical impact. Austerlitz gave Napoleon actually control of most of Central Europe. It forced the collapse of the Holy Roman Empire, which is actually gone by the spring of 1806. It forced Austrians to give up a significant amount of their influence, both in Germany, in Italy, and it established France as the dominant continental power. There's no doubt about this. It is because of Austerlitz that Napoleon can then build on the success of his first imperial recess and bring about profound restructuring of German states. It is in the wake of Austerlitz that we see creation of the Confederation of the Rhine, the new reality set in Germany, where the Holy Roman Empire, that consists of more than 330 states, is now reduced through a rather painful process of reshaping, abolition, merger, to just three dozen states. It is because of Austerlitz that we then see the French control of Italian, further control of Italian peninsula, since the Kingdom of Naples is invaded shortly after the battle is fought, and French consolidate their power in south of Italy. And it is because of Austerlitz that we see the War of Fourth Coalition, with Prussians belatedly right, joining the war effort, only to have their aspirations so brutally crushed on the fields of Jena, Auerstadt, in October of 1806.
The battles of Austerlitz and Trafalgar give us a new mise-en-scène with the death in early 1806 of the younger Pitt, who was the foremost proponent of hostilities towards revolutionary France, Napoleonic France. He leaves the scene, and then we have a Ministry of All Talents headed by Lord Grenville, with Charles James Fox, the famous Whig politician, as foreign secretary. A topic in the book, or a subject in the book, which you don't seem to really go into, is why there was no peace treaty, you know, in essence, why there was no agreement on terms between Bonaparte and this new British cabinet, which in the case of Fox as foreign secretary had been quite critical of the British efforts in the war, in terms of, from his perspective, the war could be concluded on peaceful terms with Bonaparte. And as you may recall, this is the subject matter of one of Sir Herbert Butterfield's earlier books, Napoleon's Peace Tactics. Can you go into why there was no, why there was a failure of agreement between the Ministry of All Talents and Bonaparte in terms of concluding hostilities?
I think if we're looking at mistakes that Napoleon makes, I think that's one of the mistakes, is not appreciating the importance of the moment and grab, really, the opportunities. The Minister of Talent, of All Talents, especially Fox, as you mentioned, was quite keen on signing a peace with France in the wake of rather unsuccessful war effort that had been going on for the past 3 years. And the conditions that they offered Napoleon was actually quite, I think it should have been quite acceptable to French interests. They effectively allowed France to keep all the possessions that they had, or all the conquests they had within Europe, so France would have still stayed dominant power in Western and Central Europe. Here, I think, is the issue is of personalities. I think here's the issue of ambitious, of maybe, you know, certainly of overestimating your own abilities. Napoleon is convinced that Britain is teetering on the edge. He has an opportunity to actually defeat the British, not simply to sign a peace with them on a certain parity, but to actually bring them to their knees. And that in itself would have been quite an accomplishment, he believes, right? That's a historic enemy of France. Certainly the events of Austerlitz, the events of Vienna and Auerstadt give them a sense of of all power, this omnipotence. And it's not as much of the interests or the inability to reach the compromise on certain interests. It's the Napoleon's unwillingness to accept the treaty at this time because he believes he has a lucky streak here. But also, remember that Fox dies, right, in September of 1806. That also plays a role because Fox was the, I think, greatest Francophile in the British government at the time. And his death opened the way for more hawkish members of the cabinet who were not as keen on reaching the deal with France. Bear in mind that this is a time, 1806, when Britain actually is conducting wide-ranging expeditionary warfare. This is a period when the British invaded South Africa. They conducted two invasions of Latin America, unsuccessful but nonetheless. And there are, the wide-ranging imperial interests that Britain has, not the least in India, all of which had to be brought then to negotiating table. And even though Fox was willing to do it, other members of the British government were not. It's a complex issue, but overall, I think it's Napoleon that I probably hold responsible for the failure of the peace more than anyone else.
How do you explain the relative failure of sea power in the period examined? I'm thinking in particular, obviously it can only be relative because there were many successes, but I'm thinking in particular of the failure in Corsica in 1793, the failure of to take Santo Domingue thereafter, and the, as you just mentioned, the two failures in reference to the Argentine in 1807, 1808. How do you explain those failures and the inability of the British to convert their absolute command of the sea or something approaching it by that point acquire these different possessions?
Well, again, a very good question, but very complex in the sense that Britain is the only power. France might have some claim to it, but not to the degree that British have. But Britain is the only power who is able to conduct the worldwide operations, and that consumes enormous resources. Just looking at the size of the Royal Navy, the amount of material it consumed. There were wonderful studies by Roger Knight, James Davy on these logistical sides of the Navy. It's just a staggering of the ability of the British state, of the British rule, Navy or economy to sustain this warfare. But it also meant that oftentimes these forces are stretched on a global scale. So in 1806, as I mentioned, Admiral Pavham, right, has schemes of invading Argentina, what is today Argentina. And now he does it on its own volition, right, in the wake of the invasion of South Africa, which was a sanctioned invasion. Pompey takes the troops and goes to Argentina, which causes a backlash, a whiplash, so to speak, from the British government, who didn't sanction that that invasion and was concerned of what potentially might happen. But the success, or at least this perception of success, the British had in the first attack on Buenos Aires, actually encouraged further planning and scheming. So you have these grandiose plans that Wellesley, Arthur Wellesley, the future Duke of Wellington, is approached to explore a possibility of sailing around the world, effectively coordinating a double-pronged attack on Mexico. But overall, the British track record is actually quite good in terms of conducting the operations on the sea. They're certainly superb vis-a-vis another naval force. The track record against the French or the Spanish is superb. But what happens is that the sea only secures so much of territory. The ships, as famously Walpole was referring to in the context of the Polish succession, that unless we drag the ships to Warsaw, there is not much we can do to prevent the partition. So indeed, you might have a superb navy, but that navy's reach only extends to the sea. And in order to project your power on the continents, South America, Africa, subcontinent like India, you need to have troops. And troops were something that British had to use very sparingly. Hence why those expeditions to South America are quite small, if you look at the size of the invading forces, and why they were able, why the locals were able to contain them, right? That Lord Beresford was forced to capitulate and surrender. Let's say in Indian Ocean, the British operations are quite successful, but they use a slightly different approach. So in India, it's not the British military as such, right? Not the regular army, but rather the British East India Company troops who do most of the fighting. And here the role of Wellesley is both Richard Wellesley and Arthur Wellesley is quite important. Wellesley's effectively create the British Imperial State in India. So by the time Richard Wellesley left 1805, he left an important legacy of British conquests, so that's successful. And even in the Caribbean, where the climate, where the diseases, where the many logistical challenges hampered the British efforts, by 1809, 1810, they are successful at invading the islands and securing them to the British throne. So I think overall, it's the logistical challenges that hampered the British, not necessarily other considerations.
What explains the relative failure of the French in the Iberian Peninsula campaigns from 1807 to 1813? Was it a matter of inadequate commanders, or was it more of a structural, was it more structural in nature as per the French way of war, not being able to work well in the Iberian Peninsula?
Spain, that's... Again, speaking of Napoleon's mistakes, that's yet another, it might be a cliche to say it at this junction of time, but he should not have gotten to Spain, needless to say. There are other ways, I'm arguing in the book, that he could have controlled Spain. For example, he could have forced the good old Carlos to resign in favor of his son Ferdinand, and then use Ferdinand as a proxy, because if you look at Ferdinand's letters to Napoleon, they are indicating a man who is quite insecure and would have been quite easily dominated by Napoleon. And I think Schroeder, whom you mentioned a few minutes ago, is quite correct when he, in speaking of Napoleon's actions in Spain, when he says that in talents, Napoleon was a great military captain, but in character and methods, a great capo mafioso, because the events in Spain, how he forced the Spanish royal family to resign its rights in Bayona, clearly anything but palatable. But when it comes to the war itself, I think one of the core reasons why it is unsuccessful is the reality of Napoleon misjudging the character, or the nature of the war in Spain. He should have known better, and I'm arguing about this in my book, is that French diplomats have been providing Napoleon with a steady with a steady report about how different this country was from other places that that the French had been, that the national character of Spanish people was quite different from Italian or the German or the others, and that if the intervention was would take place, that French would struggle here. Napoleon ignores all of it. And that's what boggles me, in that a voracious and inquiring reader such as Napoleon, and we know he was a voracious reader. Anyone who's seen his letters talking about the establishment of library and the type of books he selected for the library, or the mobile portable library that he created of several hundred volumes that he carried with him, all of that to me at least should have indicated that Napoleon should have known more about the country that he was invading. He should have most certainly, and we know that he read these diplomatic warnings, that, and they, I'll quote one of them, that Spaniards don't resemble any other nation. They have a noble and generous character, but which tends in the direction of ferocity, and they could not stand being treated as a conquered nation. Once driven to despair, they would be capable of the most valiant decisions and could commit the worst excesses. So this is a letter written on the eve of invasion, and this is not the sole, one just of a chance. It's a part of a steady stream of letters Napoleon receives. Later on, he's the head of his secret police and a close confidant, General Savary, will admit, and he will say that, we did underestimate the Spanish national self-esteem. But it doesn't negate the reality that Napoleon's decision to invade Spain was a fundamental miscalculation, failing to take into account the character of the nation. But then is the reality of what to do once you are there. And even though there is this, overall narrative of valiant Spanish people rising up and all jointly resisting Napoleon and ultimately defeating him, recent scholarship has shown that to be a myth. In here, I think Charles Esdale, the great British historian who has written extensively on this, has shown major problems with this traditional narrative of a Spanish uprising for God, king in the country. Esdale has shown that in most cases, the primary concern for rebels was not fighting for the monarchy or fighting for the nation as a whole, but it was instead fight for land, for bread. It was a sense of vengeance for what the French has done or have done, but also vengeance on their own Spanish property classes, that the Spaniards on a lower socioeconomic strata thought that the opportunity was ripe to seek some redress. Indeed, the guerrillas hurt the French. They intercepted communications, they attacked French convoys, and the French struggled to adjust to these guerrilla tactics, but it's not that they were unsuccessful completely. We know that there are parts of Spain where French work is quite successful. Again, Charles Esdale has written an interesting study on the French presence in Andalusia, and we see the extent of the French success there. And it is also true that by 1810, the French were able to consolidate their power in most of Spain, hence why we have this invasion of Portugal. And if there was no British presence in Portugal, if there was no Wellington, no Torres Vedras, no British resistance, and if this French invasion of Portugal had succeeded in 1811, I think the history of the Peninsula War would have been quite different. So it is not the guerrillas or the nature of the war that they were fighting that defeated the French, but it is more of a traditional, the Anglo-Portuguese-Spanish conventional war that snapped the French resources.
What were Bonaparte's failures in the Russian campaign? And were they the result of a weakening failure as a military commander? Or was it a failure to reimagine how to fight a war in a different environment from that of Central Europe?
Thank you for a very interesting question. And again, like in Spain, we see here, at least for me, it's another of those perplexing moments or conundrums if you're following Bonaparte's career, you see the capacity he has for brilliance in politics and military. And then we face this reality of 1812. 1812, I don't think it should have happened. In the book, what I'm arguing is that one of these counterfactual questions I ask is, what would have happened if Napoleon used the same resources that he had in 1812, but instead of going to Russia, he'd gone back to Spain and Portugal? What would have happened if he had expelled the British from the peninsula and consolidated the French power in the Iberian Peninsula instead of confronting the Russian threat? Because there was growing hostility, right? Tensions between Russia and France. But invading Russia should have been the very last option to be exercised. And I don't think that was where Napoleon stood in June of 1812. Once the war began, we see a few problems. It is a myth that Napoleon did not prepare logistically for this war. No, anyone who has read his correspondence knows the extent to which he spent the previous year preparing for the war, enormous logistical preparations for food, for supplies, for uniforms, all of this. But I think he underestimated the extent to which Russia was underdeveloped. And again, he should have listened. His diplomats, including Colin Kuhr, provided a steady stream of reports saying that this country is quite different. One of the things that startled me as I was working on this book and I was researching in the National Archives in Paris, there are massive stacks of documents relating to this campaign, is the simple things like the lack of maps. You would think that if when you're going to a country like Russia, you would have maps. And of course, they did have maps, but one of the things that they figure out quickly enough in the first 2 weeks of the war was that the maps were inadequate. And so you see these letters back and forth between Napoleon and his marshals expressing complete frustration about how inadequate the maps were. Berthier, Napoleon's chief of staff, writes to marshals like Davout, saying, "We don't even know where you are located because the location that you're writing about is not on the map. So please," there's one of the letters that says, "please, as you go along, please create your own maps and send them to us so we can create a larger visual representation of the area that we occupy." So that in itself is a problem, right? Now, the French army did carry a significant amount of resources with them, but the lack of roads, especially in places like the Northern Front or the Southern Front, that is not covered as much in the traditional narrative, shows the complete lack of infrastructure. So unlike Central Europe, unlike Northern Italy, unlike German states where Napoleon has been fighting in the previous years and that had actually a good roadway, road networks, Russia is lacking them. And whatever roads they had were made of the wood, of the timber, covered with mud, with some soil that turned into a nightmare as soon as it rained. And it did rain shortly after the invasion began. But of course, that is one part of the story. And the second part is the Russian ability to conduct a masterful campaign. There is a long debate, and I've been part in through my own writings, whether Russians had a clear plan of action. My conviction is that they did. We don't have one single piece of document saying this is what we're going to do, but we have little bits and pieces that we can reconstruct the overall picture. So we see, for example, memorandums that are written by people like Peter Tchurkevich, an official at the Ministry of War, advising the Minister of War, Mikhail Barkalai Dertoli, who himself is a very important figure in this story. And Tchurkevich, in his memo, argues in favor of a prolonged war of retreating, surrendering the territory in exchange for time. He argues in the war, like the war in Spain, the Russians had the benefit of studying the events in Spain, and they realized the challenges that Napoleon was facing there, and they wanted to replicate those challenges within Russia, and to a great degree, they are successful in this. Speaking of which, Chukievich's memo was unknown in Western scholarship, and I translated it, so anyone interested in reading it can simply Google it and find it online for free, and see what was the type of war that Chukievich and the senior officials of the Minister of War argued in favor. The Minister of War, Barclay de Tolly, was a keen proponent of a prolonged warfare, of a very methodical war. He was not the only man, but to argue in favor of it. But he faced a steady, rather fierce resistance from other elements of the Russian military. So my fellow Georgian, like me, General Peter Bagration, was actually a proponent of a short war, a decisive showdown with the French. And if Bagration had been appointed the commander-in-chief in 1812, the war would have been exactly what Napoleon wanted, a short and decisive victory for the French. Bagration would have rushed into a confrontation that would have been disastrous. But it is rather fortunate for the Russians to have a steady individual like Barclay de Tolly to ensure that this policy of methodical retreat, scorched earth policy, is carried out in this crucial first month and a half of the war. And even though Barclay de Tolly is removed from command in August, the legacy that he left is that by that time the Russian armies already are deep into the Russian territories. French, by necessity, have followed them all the way to Moscow. And Napoleon has seen much of the force that he had squandered away.
From your perspective, what was the single greatest failure of Bonaparte's Russian campaign?
You mean in terms of military or the political?
Either one or both.
So if we look at the military side, the campaign is interesting because Napoleon, whenever he engages the Russians, he is largely successful. So, Battle of Smolensk, French won. Battle of Ostrovno, they won. The great maneuver at Smolensk is quite actually brilliant. Even the Battle of Borodino, which is bloody, but nonetheless a French victory. Even during the retreat, French are able to hold their hold themselves battle ready, whether at Maler and Yaroslavets or at Krasny, where the Russian attempts to destroy them are largely unsuccessful. Berezina, on which I wrote a book, might not be the French victory, as some French historians claim it, but it was nonetheless success in extricating the French military from a very dangerous situation when Russians should have destroyed the remnants of it. So militarily, there are some problems that we see on the French side, but it's problems that deal with both exhaustion in the second part of the campaign, the collapsing structure of it. We talk about divisions that are reduced to in scale to just a few hundred men. We talk about regiments that's just a few dozen men. But it's also the problem of Napoleon's maybe lack of imagination. I think that plays out especially true at Borodino, right? When other marshals, most famously Davout, urges Napoleon a more flexible approach to the battle. Davout suggests a flanking maneuver to do it like the French used to do, right? Pin down the enemy and then smash from one of the flanks. And Napoleon chooses not to do it, fearful that the Russians will continue to retreat. And instead, he chooses a very conventional, straight-on attack that caused horrific casualties. But on the political side, what I see here is, again, a failure of Napoleon to appreciate the moment. When he captured Moscow in September of 1812, he spent in this city 36 days. 36 days in a city that burned shortly after the French entrance, in a city that was just a smoldering ruins, and yet he chose to spend there 36 days waiting for what? Waiting for the Russians to ask for peace. Furthermore, when he realized that Russian peace overtures were not coming, Napoleon sent his own request for peace, only to see them rebuffed, and yet he stayed. And I think that's a failure of political imagination here. If anything, he should have declared peace, or declared the war over. You know, effectively say, I won the war, I captured Moscow, even though it's not the capital anymore, right? St. Petersburg is, but nonetheless, he could have claimed it. He could have used propaganda machine to have turned this war in his, portrayed the war in his favor, and then retreated back into western provinces of Russian Empire, regrouped in places like today's Belarus or Poland or Lithuania, and then resumed the war next spring. But he didn't. He waited for too long. And my argument is that Napoleon here failed to understand how profoundly his relationship with Emperor Alexander of Russia had changed, or how profoundly the mood of Russian society had changed. Alexander knew very well of the widespread displeasure that prevailed in Russia over his perceived subservience to Napoleon. He knew how upset the Russian society was about Tilsit, where for many Russians it seemed that the Russian interests were sacrificed, and he knew particularly of the extent that discontent increased during this invasion of 1812. Let me quote a letter that his sister, Catherine, wrote to Alexander in September of 1812. And here's the quote. She says, "Discontent is at its highest, and your person," so she refers to Alexander himself, "your person is far from being spared. If such news reaches me, you can imagine the rest. You openly accused of having brought disaster upon your empire, or having caused general ruin and the ruin of private individuals. Lastly, of having lost the honor of your country." So I don't see any way Alexander would have accepted a deal with Napoleon on the terms that Napoleon wanted them. It might sound as me rehashing the same idea, but Napoleon should have known this. If anything, on the eve of the war, his ambassador to Russia, Colin Court, tells him about the conversation he had with Emperor Alexander, during which Alexander warned Napoleon that if the war started, it will not be over until French got out completely of Russia, and that, quote, he was willing to go all the way to Kamchatka to fight the war. And yet Napoleon ignored this.
What explains Bonaparte's failures in the German campaigns of 1813? Were they more tactical or a matter of logistics, particularly shortages of horses?
Part of the problem is the logistics. You're absolutely right about the lack of cavalry. The Russian campaign decimated the French cavalry force, and it would have taken at least 2 years to fully, at least 2 years to fully rebuild the French cavalry force. And in the absence of cavalry, Napoleon was unable to fully exploit the early victory he scored. So it's not as much tactical, because if we look at the battles of Lutzen and Bautzen in May of 1813, Napoleon is quite brilliant. Even with the inexperienced troops that he has, the newly recruited conscripts from France, he still is capable of inflicting serious defeats on the coalition forces. But this lack of cavalry, as well as certain mistakes by some of his subordinates, contributed to this inability to exploit the victories. But to me, the answer to your question is more on the other side of the story, and that is the ability of the Allies, the Russians, the Austrians, the Prussians, to learn from the previous lessons, to adjust their approach to the war. So we know that in the wake of the defeats of 1806, Prussia spent the last few years mobilizing, or restructuring, reforming the forces of the Prussian army in 1813. It's quite different from the one that Napoleon was facing in 1806. Same applies for Austria in the wakes of defeats, also in the fields of Austerlitz and elsewhere. Austrians were reforming their forces, and same applies to the Russians, right? In the wake of Austerlitz and other defeats, Russian army went through a period of reform. And during this reforming period, these countries were borrowing bits and pieces of the French experience and adjusting them to their own expectations. And even bigger, I think, of bigger importance is the ability of the coalition to work together. So unlike previous coalitions, so in 1805, third coalition, or in 1806, the fourth coalition, Napoleon, in 1813, what we see is the coalition partners on the field, next to each other, at the same time. So let me remind the listener that when this war of third coalition began in 1805, Napoleon in the first faced Austrians, and then the Russian army was still on its way, but before it arrived, the Austrian army was destroyed. And then Napoleon was able to deal with the Russians. The Prussians did not join the war. They mobilized, but did not. And then the following year, they decided to enter the war, only to be destroyed separately. So what we see in the previous cases is the Napoleon facing not a united coalition. Right? We speak about these coalitions, but they are not united. They are not coordinating their efforts as such. Until 1813. In 1813, we see this coalition of Russia, Prussia, Austria, well funded by the British, coalescing at the same time that their armies take the field. And it is here that we see another mistake Napoleon makes, and that is accepting the armistice of Clausewitz. In the wake of his early victories in May of 1813, the Allies and Napoleon agree on negotiating a certain peace, even though neither side actually was interested in having peace deal as such. And the Clausewitz armistice, which went through all of June and July, allowed the Allies to develop a strategy to mobilize fully their forces, and that's especially true for the Austrians, so that when the war was resumed in August of 1813, Napoleon, for the first time in his career, is facing a full-fledged, fully formed coalition force. And he finds it very difficult to fight this war, a war where the coalition partners are coordinating their actions, so that if Napoleon reaches towards the Army of North, he's facing an army of Bohemia or army of Silesia, and he's unable to deal with multiple threats at the time. His solution, right, famously, is to stay in one place at Leipzig, expecting the coalition to converge and fight him there, which they do, but the French lost.
Actually, you anticipate my next question, which was Great War historiography, in terms of the military campaigns, there is a term which is frequently used called the learning curve. Opponents of Bonaparte, which particular army, Prussian, Russian, Austrian, or for that matter, British, would you say was best at adapting to the French style of warfare?
This is a very interesting and a complex question that you asked, because we see individual armies or individual countries and armies adjusting in their own way to the French threat. In most cases, it's not the tactical changes that they implement, but more of a structural organizational changes that focus on streamlining, focus on efficiency, command and control. So one of the core innovations that spreads at this time in places like Austria and Prussia and Russia is the core structure that the French developed. So instead of ad hoc divisions and ad hoc corps, we see a permanent structures emerging, just like the one that Napoleon established in French army in 1802 or 3, when we have a corps that's consisting of several divisions of combined arms, right, infantry, artillery, and cavalry. And those core systems will be borrowed by Russians and Austrians and Prussians, so that by 1813 he's facing an enemy that organizationally and structurally is fighting a similar way. Tactically, I don't think there is a much difference, so to speak, between the way these armies fought. It's more of a ability of the commander in general to tactically outclass, outmatch the opponent that is at the heart of the story here. So that individual Austrian soldiers were as brave as the French. The same applies for the Russians, right? Napoleon famously says in frustration that it's not enough to simply kill the Russian soldier, you also need to knock him down, because he still continues to fight on after being dead. On individual levels, these armies have a brave, devoted soldiers who continue, who went through a horrifying experience on the battlefield. But it's the brilliance of commanders that is a problem. When we deal with individuals like Wittgenstein, right? Peter Ludwig Wittgenstein, the Russian commander-in-chief in the spring of 1813, I don't think he was anywhere on the level of Napoleon, and hence we see the Russian setbacks. In Austria, on the other hand, in earlier campaigns, we see adjustments that Archduke Charles famously advocated, right, in 1806, 1807, 1808, all leading to the War of 1809, and we see how the organizationally different Austrian army was able to hold its ground against the French and at Wagram. But I think it still was lacking that certain oomph that the French had, and maybe Napoleon is the oomph that they were missing. Right? Wellington famously speaks of Napoleon being, equivalent to 40,000 men on the battlefield, because he does have, Napoleon does have this ability to look at the battlefield and understand what needs to be done. The coup d'oeil that he has, where he quickly grasps the battlefield and what should be the reaction. He's a great improviser. I don't think the opponents had that kind of commander in general, with exception for the British. And I have a utmost respect and admiration for the Duke of Wellington.
If you wanted people to take one thing away from your book, what would it be?
The biggest thing that I tried to achieve in this book was to underscore the scale and the extent of the impact that this war had. I'm originally from country of Georgia, and growing up, I've read, as many other kids and young adults do, a lot of books, and certainly I was drawn to Napoleon's story. And oftentimes I was frustrated that it was too focused on Napoleon or too focused on events in Western Central Europe. And my goal in writing this book was to broaden this narrative. We are living in ever increasingly a globalized world, a world of connections, a world where butterflies' wings in one part of the world can cause ripples on the other. And that's the argument of this book, is that Napoleon is not just a European figure, but he is a figure who inadvertently, that's not part of his plan, but inadvertently oftentimes causes profound changes elsewhere. I argue in this book that Napoleon ultimately is a loser. He lost. His empire is erased from the map of Europe. France is in a worse shape in 1815 than it was in 1800 when Napoleon came to power. But it's the ramifications outside the Europe that is of interest to me. So inadvertently, Napoleon becomes an architect of a modern Latin America. His invasion of Spain is not just important because it causes the Iberian struggles. It's not important because of the British interventions in 1809 through 1814 and the power struggles it unleashed. But it is this invasion is important because what it does in Latin America, where it forces the Spanish colonies to reassess their own sense of identity and place. It forces them to choose. Should they stay loyal to the Bourbon monarchy that was overthrown? Should they receive Napoleon's emissaries and pledge loyalty to Napoleon? Or should they actually choose a third, yet unknown path? And we know that many of them do choose this third path, so that by 1825, Latin America is free of Spanish colonial control. Instead, we see the emergence of the modern countries such as Argentina or Colombia. So that's where I see the impact of the Napoleonic Wars. And if the book is hoping to show something, is to show how transforming this conflict was. Another area I would remind the readers or the listeners of this podcast is the impact Napoleon had on the Middle East. His invasion of Egypt has a profound consequences by shattering the existing status quo, removing the Mamluk government, right, the authority that dominated Egypt for the past few hundred years, and creating a political vacuum that is then filled in by the maverick Mehmed Ali, who goes on reforming, borrowing actually French practices, reforming Egypt and introducing important changes that turn Egypt and the powerhouse that is capable of challenging the Ottoman Empire in 1830s and 40s to profound consequences. Same applies to the Ottoman Empire and Iran. If Napoleon, one of the things the Napoleonic Wars showed is the problem that these countries had in confronting the threat of European powers. So the Ottomans had to deal with the Russian territorial aggrandizement. They had to deal with the growing power of Napoleon, and they were unable to adjust to the reality. Same applies in Iran, where the Napoleonic war spilled over all the way to Iran, forcing the Shah to choose whether he wanted to stay with the French and side them with them against the Russians, or to stay with the British against the French. And all this geopolitical maneuvering ultimately produced the biggest impact that I'm arguing in the book, and is this. The most enduring Napoleonic legacy is creation of reform-minded elites in Ottoman Empire, in Iran, that did not question the cultural norms or social structures on which the traditional order rested in this country, but instead believed that this Napoleonic style or European style military and administrative reforms were absolutely crucial to the survival of the state, because these reforms would have enabled them to consolidate their domestic power and to protect their states more effectively. But these reforms entailed the introduction of Western practices into Islamic society, and as such, they posed challenges to existing power structures, because these reforms, as Napoleon carried them out, were about centralization. They were about inserting central government into the daily life of its subjects much more directly and much more pervasively than ever before, which is why we see a reaction to this. So your listeners probably know about the Ottoman Janissaries resisting these reforms that Sultan Selim III initiated, or the Qizilbash elite refusing to accept the reforms that the Crown Prince Abbas urged in Iran. And these groups reacted very negatively to these reforms and rejected them, even though these modernizing changes would have better protected their respective states. And so one of the themes of this book is that this confrontation increasingly came to be seen as a struggle for the very essence of Islamic way of life. And I think its profound effects continue to reverberate to the present day.
Well, with that observation, I would like to thank you very much, Professor Mika Berditsa, for being so kind to speak with us today. I should point out that this is a truly splendid book, and it's actually reviewed in the current issue of the New York Review of Books. This is Charles Cutillo. Thanks for listening to New Books in History, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. Thank you, Professor.
Thank you so much for a very enjoyable interview. Appreciate it.